Hey, just a heads up that the following content may be disturbing or triggering for some listeners and is not appropriate for children. Please take care of yourself and others who may be listening with you.
Welcome to the Bonus Babies Podcast, a show that has no easy answers, only hard questions.
We should always speak to young people, and especially children, in adverse circumstances. We need to speak to them in the language of their dreams and not of our adult realities, because children are dreamers very much. And so the books that I read gave me this sense of, okay, so there is an intact world out there. And so when I read Encyclopedia Brown and he would solve mysteries with his dad, and I'm like, oh, so that's the kind of dad I'm going to be one day.
Can you tell me what you call the kids who you've cared for over the years?
We feel that the children that we receive coming into our home are bonuses. So we call them bonus babies.
I love that.
This is your host, Jane Amelia Larson, and I'm a CASA, a court-appointed special advocate volunteer for youth in foster care. Yeah, I know, it's a mouthful. In the same way a CASA works, I explore all things in the foster care maze, by talking to kids, parents, caregivers, attorneys, social workers, therapists, really anybody and everybody who will speak to me to keep the conversation open and the information flowing about all things CASA.
Hi there. This is Jake Eberle, the producer of the Bonus Babies podcast. And today, Jane Amelia speaks with Steve Pemberton. Steve Pemberton was taken from his mother at the age of 3 because she was unfit to care for him. It's his first memory. He was placed in one horrible home after another, but a pretty magical thing happened to him. A woman who lived nearby gave him books on a regular basis. And the more he read, the more his outlook on the world changed. This new knowledge inspired him to take his life into his own hands. He escaped from the brutality of his situation and created the life he believed he should have. Here's Steve Pemberton.
Hey, I'm here with Steve Pemberton. Hey, Steve.
Hey there. How are you?
Am I pronouncing your name correctly, Pemberton?
You've got it. Just the way it sounds phonetically, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good name. So tell me a little bit about who you are, where you're from, your family of origin.
That's literally a book, quite literally.
I know, and you've written 3 books.
Yes.
We're going to talk about those too.
So I currently call home the Chicagoland area, although I am originally from Massachusetts, New Bedford, Massachusetts specifically, which is a community that's about an hour and a half south of Boston, a bit of the way on the way to Cape Cod.
I know that land a little bit.
Sure.
And you have very few memories of your early years, right?
Like most children, you can't really recall the early years. But in many ways, what really began kind of my quest, as it were, was a journey or a memory, actually, that I had so consistently and so repeatedly that I didn't know if it was a dream or a memory. And the only reason I leaned towards it being a memory was because of how consistent it was over the years. But I didn't know what it was connected to. And the memory was of one cold night feeling, well, one being physically in a car, going somewhere, but a sense of being uprooted and a sense of being disconnected from something, but didn't know what that was. Until I read my case file from the Department of Social Services, and as I'm flipping through this case file, I begin to read this passage that is nearly identical to this memory that I've had. And I realize at this point, so this was not a dream. This was indeed a memory. And what's more, the reason that I have remembered this is because it was the day that I was taken from my mother and I was to never see her again. So I was about 3 years old, 3 and a half years old. And that is, if you were to ask me, so what's your first memory? That is my first memory.
Right, like etched in your brain.
Absolutely.
And at the time, as you were feeling it throughout your life, seeing it throughout your life, you didn't realize that the other person next to you was actually your sister. You only learned that later.
Much later. Right? I mean, I was cognizant that there was somebody else in the car with me, and I knew that that other person was a child, but I did not know why I was in the car with that child. And I certainly didn't have any connection to that individual in my own memory until when I was reading that case file and realized that when social workers came to take me and my sister from my mother that day, that's how that other child in the car wound up with me, is because the authorities came to take both of us, not just me.
Right. And she got dropped off first at a different place from you. So you were separated from her. And even if you didn't remember it when you were 10 or 12, I'm sure at the time you must have been bereft to not only have been taken from the only home you knew, but then taken from a sibling who you were at least with for a moment, right? Or no?
No, because I didn't know who that child was. Yeah. So I did not know that was my sister.
Right.
Until I read the case file. That's when I realized that this other child who was with me, I had a connection to. In fact, I remember thinking that maybe I was with a group of kids and we were moved. And then I realized, actually, no, this was a very specific situation that unfolded at that time.
But you did have other siblings. So what happened to them? Because you were all together at one point with your mom. In fact, your older brother, one of them took care of you. You have a scar on your foot you wrote about in your book.
Sure. So I was one of my mother's six children. Five of us survived. My twin sister did not. She died shortly after we were born. And it was really a reflection of the struggles that my mother was having. She almost certainly had some very serious mental health challenges, but they were never diagnosed. I couldn't tell you what they were. She was in the middle of a losing battle with alcoholism, and she was disconnected from her family. And she was a very difficult person to try and help. And whether it was the Department of Social Services in Massachusetts, whether it was her own family, it was very difficult for her. And given what she was battling, that would make some sense. So me and my siblings, and we're all half siblings, by the way, only me and my sister have the same father. And again, this nomadic, fleeting sets of relationships that my mother has, because she's just navigating a very difficult world for her. And so we're often left to fend for ourselves. And because I'm as young as I am, my older brother, and I read this in the case file, was at 7 years old, responsible for taking care of me, my sister, and my youngest brother. And he was 7 years old. And it's,
wow.
You know, it's just, you can imagine there's a lot for him to deal with as a 7 year old, a lot for all of us to deal with.
Yeah. How did you happen to come upon those case files? Because a lot of kids never get to see their case files. And even when they do, they're just in pieces, or there's whole sections missing. Or did you just get lucky, or did you just go searching and were vigilant, or what?
I was certainly vigilant. I made a formal request to the Department of Social Services. My case file was not closed. So there was nothing that, if I asked, that would have prevented me from getting it. I just never knew that I could gain access to it. So yeah, I did not get access to that case file until I was in my early 40s. So I didn't even know that it existed. And when I did, request it, I remember the sheer size of it. And it alerted me to this reality that there was a lot more to my life journey than I realized. And so one, I realized that from the size of the case file, and then the other was when it began. It began in 1962, which is 5 years before I was born. So it gave me a sense of that already, 5 years before I actually even arrived in the world, that my mother was in a very difficult situation and needed help. And it would only grow in need, that help would only grow in need as time moved on.
So the first home that you went to was with the Andrades, right?
And
they were cruel.
Andrade is how the name is pronounced. Yes.
I say, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Andrade. Yeah. Because I'm in California, we say Andrade.
Yes, yes.
They left you all alone. They pretty much abandoned you and just fend for yourself.
That was obviously very hard to read about a family who you've been left with. And, you know, what's brought you there, really, the Department of Social Services has brought you there to this home. And they have brought you to this home because they believe that this home is going to be a good place for you. And the Andrades were very clever in their ability to present themselves as a caring family. But they weren't. And in fact, as I was, again, flipping through the case file, I had my own memories. So it was this juxtaposition. Because on one hand, I have my own memories of the Andrades. And then I have the case file. And this difference between the two. How I remember the Andrades were those people who were not, they simply were not kind. And what I remembered the most was I had at that age a fear of getting in a car, but I'm too young to articulate why I'm afraid of getting in a car. Now, the reason is because I've had this memory that I described before of being taken from my mother. So cars to me at that age are not safe places. Something about your life's going to change.
Danger zone.
Yes, when you get in the car.
Yeah.
So when I go to the Andrades and they're going somewhere and they say, get in the car, and I'm like, absolutely not. You know, if I get in this car, something bad's going to happen, basically. But I can't explain that to anybody because you're too young. And so the Andrade.
You're 3, you're 4 years old, you're just a kid trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And the Andrade's response to that is to leave me on the front steps of their home. And I stayed there all day until they came back. And shortly after that, I was actually taken. No, shortly after that, now this is where the case file comes in. Shortly after that is when the Andrades have shared with the Department of Social Services that they basically don't want me anymore. And they had brought in another child who became the source of their affections. And so they, you know, said to the Department of Social Services, we basically want you to come get Steve, which is what they did.
And do you have any memory of that at all?
No.
You just remember they were unkind and you didn't feel safe with them.
And I remember them leaving me on the front steps of a home all day. I mean, that was a terrifying experience. You know, I don't know why they left me, but I also don't know if they're coming back. You know,
right,
I mean, it's a very traumatic set of circumstances. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you have children now, and I know they're probably a little bit older than 3, right?
Oh, a lot older. Yeah.
You've seen what a 3-year-old is like.
Of course, yes.
And how much they need.
Mm.
So the idea of them leaving you all alone for the whole day and not worrying about you, not trying to appease you, not trying to make you feel safe, not trying to look after you at all. I mean, they were doing the exact opposite.
I think it's the kind of thing that as I got older, And especially when I became a father, it made less sense.
How could anybody do it, right?
How could anybody treat a child like that? What kind of, and I did think of them over the years as I would do anybody now. You know, I think of them as monsters, you know, because that's an incredibly barbaric thing to do to a child who's done nothing wrong. The child's done nothing wrong.
Yeah, and then you met more monsters, amazingly enough.
Yeah,
right?
The Andrades were they were just a precursor, to the Robinsons. And the Robinsons with whom I would stay for over 11 years, that was truly hell on earth. I mean, these people were incredibly shrewd, manipulative, deceitful. Their ability to present me as this broken boy who had all kinds of problems was very skillful. And they did fool everybody. They're very good at it.
They fooled everybody for years and years and years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I watched them do it. You know, I watched them. So much so now that I think about the social workers on my case at the time. I think about my teachers. It was almost, in a way, you feel bad for them because they didn't know what they were up against. And how could you know? Like, I mean, I know that social workers oftentimes are on the receiving end of a great deal of criticism. And in their defense, and in defense of my social workers, there's no training, actually, to deal with the Andrades or the Robinsons. There's no real training for you to prepare for somebody who treats a child like that. And why? Because your lens is as you've got your graduate degree in social work. You wake up every day thinking about what it is that you can do that is the best for a child. You're not waking up like the Andrades and the Robinsons were with me. How can I continue to fool people? You know, so you're almost unarmed in terms of dealing with those kinds of individuals.
Yeah, and even after one particularly bad beating, and I guess I should say out loud, people will know this, but I have just recently read your book, A Chance in the World. It's very moving. It's obviously heartbreaking. It also fills me with hope that even kids who go through a really tough time, mm-hmm. some of them somehow, like you, can survive it and get to the other side, mm-hmm. which is pretty damn amazing. And what I think is also great is that you've written essentially a kid's version of that. And I'm really hoping that there are kids out there that are reading it, that have access to it, because it's inspiring, like truly inspiring. And so anyway, I just want to ask you, after a particularly bad beating, there was a nurse at the hospital who, I mean, looked like you were going to get saved, but then that didn't happen.
No. So the specific incident that sent me to the hospital, I did so armed with a story that the foster family wants to make sure I keep telling. And so every time I'm asked what has happened, I lie because I've been instructed to lie.
That's right.
I've told that if I don't lie, then kids like me disappear all the time and nobody's ever going to ask what happened to you.
Right.
Remember, your own mother and father didn't want you. So anything, you know, can happen. So that's at the forefront of my mind. And remember, at the same time, this is a family, foster family, that's well known for taking in foster children. So they win awards.
They were saints, right? Yeah. They were saints as far as the community was concerned.
Yeah. So you're really up against, you know, you're up against a monster, really. That's how I saw it. But in this one particular hospital visit, this nurse, and certainly this is my memory, and this is what unfolds in the case file as well, is this nurse does not believe my story. And she is trying to get me to tell her the truth, but I can't, because remember, something's going to happen to me if I tell the truth.
Yeah, something worse.
So
yeah, something
meanwhile,
even worse, right?
When I flip through the case file, I can see that she was doing a lot more than just trying to get me to tell the truth. She's also telling her fellow nurses, and she's telling the emergency room physicians, and she's telling the primary care physician that this boy is being abused. He has old bruises on him. He came to the hospital. We had to stitch him up in his scalp because he has all these lacerations.
Right, all over, right? And and Mrs. Robinson claimed that you fell out of the...
That was playing around in a shopping carriage and fell out. And the nurse, though,
right,
says, well, how can you get all of those... How can you get multiple lacerations, you know, from a single fall?
Right.
He didn't fall in glass. So you could see in the case file that the doctor says, well, I know the family and she has taken in children for years. So, you know, you combine that with her saying, well, you know, look at him. Something about him isn't quite right. So you realize that, you know, you're in a very perilous situation, even at that age. I mean, I realized like this is, I'm never going to get out of here because of how good they are. But I should also point out, though, that even in the midst of all of that, the joy that I find and the skills that I'm developing as a result of navigating that is going to ultimately lead to my freedom and to my escape. And so,
so ironic, isn't it, that you had to develop all these skills and in order to survive this very, very dangerous household, you develop skills to help yourself survive and ultimately escape.
Well, and I would say that that's much more common than we think.
Oh, I know. No, I'm well aware of that, actually.
And it's especially true in the case of children. So we hear stories of those who survived the Holocaust and the Middle Passage, which are probably the two biggest blights of humanity, the Holocaust and slavery.
Right.
And you hear these stories of how people survived those journeys and the mental strength they had and all of those things. So you hear a lot of those stories. But there's one particular one around the orphan that's right in front of us, but we don't actually think about it this way. There's a reason that most of the superheroes that we know and have grown up with and have read about, they all have one thing in common. They were all orphans. Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, Jane Eyre, Little Orphan Annie, Frodo Baggins, Harry Potter, Wonder Woman. I mean, the list goes on.
You got that right.
Right.
Right. Either they were orphans or they had some kind of lived foster care experience.
Yes.
They were raised by the grandparents or raised by their aunt and uncle or by a cousin or in a home full of other orphans.
Yes. Right. And therefore,
like Guardians of the Galaxy. Right?
Yes. So. And so there's this direct connection between being dislocated like that and developing super skills, in essence.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Of course, mythology being what mythology is, it's, you know, you can fly and you can have a spider web, right?
All those superpowers.
Right, you have a wand like Harry Potter, right? But when you move out of the world of fantasy and into the real world, those super skills, maybe they're not superpowers, but they're definitely super skills.
Super skills,
and
for sure.
I think that for anyone listening to us, that the more and more that we can help those children in those situations find out what their superpower is and talk to them like they have one that is not yet discovered, it's a very different frame and lens than what is our immediate reach, right? Which is to protect, which is to serve, which is to save, all of which we should be doing.
Mm-hmm. As well.
As right. well, of course. Yeah. If and first, I would argue, and at the same time, try to say in a very quiet, like whisper, so, hey, you know, do you know that you have a superpower? Like you have one.
Yeah.
And now, even as I think about my own life journey, I will confess that I think faster than most people. I am very quick to move to a solution on something. Those were skills that I developed as a result of having to navigate the foster home that I was in. And there's a lot of children in care, in adverse care situations, who have those same skills.
I have seen that as well. I've seen that kids in care often, they really know how to read a room really quick.
Mm-hmm.
They're often very, very adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
They can quickly change and move and adjust in a way that probably has been developed in order to protect them, in order to save themselves from either an unsafe situation or one in which they're not sure what's going to happen. So, and terrifically observant,
mm-hmm.
often very empathetic because they immediately recognize in other people who have experienced a lot of pain.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. And I really appreciate you saying that out loud and for our audience to hear that, because it's not just a question of taking care of these kids. It's imbuing them with their ability to see their own special strengths, skills, whatever it's going to be.
Sure. Yeah. And they have
so that they can.
Yeah.
And they absolutely have them. Yeah. And in a healthy family, that might happen naturally, just as the kid grows, you know, in a happy, loving family.
Yeah.
That's what good parents do.
Yes.
But when a kid doesn't have good parents, that they have to do it for themselves.
And, or they have to have someone help them find that for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you ended up, of course, like many of my guests that have been on this program somehow, you ended up saving yourself. It was a couple of days after Christmas, and finally you'd had enough. And it's freezing cold. You go outside. You have no coat on even.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens?
You know, at that point, I was old enough, at 16 years old, I was old enough to recognize quite a few things. One, you know, my mother and father were never going to come for me. I realized that even before I got into my teenage years.
Right, because you had been hoping, it was a dream, that they were going to show up and rescue you, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I didn't know, I had no memory. Even that memory I had of being taken away from something, I did not know that was my mother I was being taken away from.
Right, you didn't have an image of your mother.
No, and I still don't.
And you didn't have an image of your father.
No, right? neither of them. I have no memory of any, you know, the sound of her voice. It's only from pictures. And there aren't any videos of my mother. There are of my father, but not of my mother. So I couldn't even tell you the way she moved or anything like that. So, you know, I think realizing, okay, they're not coming for me, realize that. Number two, I realized that I'm up against this really evil force here in the Robinsons. And the third thing I realize is that college is going to be my way out. And my first attraction to college was when a seventh grade guidance counselor told me that when you went to college, you also lived there.
Yeah, you could get out.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So for me, what appealed to me about college was that I wouldn't have to go back to the Robinsons. That's what was so appealing to me about college. And so I decided that that's where I was going to go. Now, as I got older, of course, I realized, you know, there's a lot of other reasons that you go to college. And
let me ask you about the neighbor, Mrs. Levin, who gave you books. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen her again? Ever been in touch with her?
Oh,
again?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, how fabulous.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So when A Chance in the World was written, people in the neighborhood and in the community of New Bedford read it, and people in that neighborhood read it, knew who I was talking about, because she lived a couple blocks away. So she used to walk to the neighborhood grocery store. And so people saw her all the time. And the other reason they remembered her is because she was known as a very kind and giving person. So she had a reputation in that neighborhood for being a benefactor of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And what she gave to me were books that she would often bring me. Well, some 35 years later, people read my book in which I talked about her bringing me books. And they said, oh, we know who that is. Because I didn't know who it was, but they did. They said, oh, that's Claire Levin. So they called around a local synagogue trying to find her. And they called one synagogue one town over. There was a rabbi, and the rabbi said, yeah, that's Claire Levin, and here's where she lives. So I went to visit her, and some 35 years later, and I got to ask her, you know, why did she do that? You know, over the course of over a decade, bring me books like that? And she never knew how important they were to me. She didn't know that it helped me to fall in love with literature, therefore making me a good student, and therefore college material. And she didn't know any of that effect that she was having at all. And I thought her answer to the question, well, why did you do that, was so profound and so instructive for all of us. Because she said, I wasn't doing anything extraordinary. I was just doing what my mother told me it was my responsibility to do, which, she said, was to give from where you are with whatever you have. Now, not knowing the effect, not knowing the impact, any of that. Now, I want us to think, Jane, just for a moment about our world today and how many people, far too many people, actually, wake up and sow the seeds of discord. They get on social media and they attack and they critique and they shout down and they bully and they blame and they have enormous egos. They live in a me first world. And this kind woman, Claire Levin, did not live her life like that. See, she woke up every day asking, who can I help? Whose life can I make better? That's how she woke up every day. And she was not, she graduated from high school. She never went to college. She didn't work in corporate America. She didn't have a lot of money. She wasn't famous. None of those things. But what an extraordinary human being she was. What a hero, you know, she was. And what a way, you know, that one can live your life, you know, which is why I always smile at whether I see in the world of celebrity or in the world of politics. And we talked earlier about, you know, how a lot of kids who grow up in foster care, how observant they are, how insightful they are, their ability to see through things. And I see a lot of those things and I have the shallowness of it, the ego of it. You can see right through it, of course, no matter how much perfume they try and spray on the pig, you can kind of see it. And then on the other hand, you have a Claire Levin who just kept bringing me books and what motivated her.
Yeah, but also what was cool about that is that you learned a lot about how to help yourself from those books as well, right?
Yeah, it was not just, you know, books, but it was the kind of books that she brought me. And so whether it was, you know, Jules Verne and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or whether it was my favorite, Watership Down, you know, there are worlds of imagination and exploration. And I saw myself in those worlds, which is really important, I think, for any child in that situation, is we've got to, there's things, if you think about it this way, in terms of scales. Now, they have come into the world with some things on a scale, and it could be a degree of fracture in their own family. It could be the scars from multiple placement. That's already on that scale. But they have done nothing to deserve that. They've committed no crime. They've done nothing wrong.
They're just born.
They're just born. A very difficult set of circumstances. So that was their crime. So, like, we have to put, like, something else on the other scale, right? And on that other scale is their possibilities. We should always speak to young people, and especially children, and especially children in adverse circumstances. We need to speak to them in the language of their dreams and not of our adult realities, because children are dreamers very much. And so the books that I read gave me this sense of, okay, so there is an intact world out there. And so when I read Encyclopedia Brown and he would solve mysteries with his dad, and I'm like, oh, so that's the kind of dad I'm going to be one day.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And so when Alfred Hitchcock would help the three investigators solve mysteries, well, I was the fourth investigator, you know?
right. That's so cool.
Right. So to me, that was the world that was on the other scale, is my point. So, yes, I have all this that's coming from first being taken from my mother and the Andrades and then the Robinsons. That's on one scale. And then on the other scale is this other world that I'm already trying to create.
And then you started that by escaping. And the social worker asked you, well, he couldn't place you.
He couldn't place you. There wasn't anybody. Didn't anybody that wanted you? It was a couple days after Christmas. No place.
Well, you know, I was the most difficult kind of child to place at any time of the year. I'm 16. I'm male. I'm black. I have this huge case file following me around that says that I've done something wrong.
Right.
And so it's a very desperate circumstance, especially at 16. And now at this time, you know, if you think about it, in the midst of the holidays. But there was, when my social worker asked me, do you know anybody? The only name person that came to mind was somebody who worked at the high school in a college access program called Upward Bound. His name was John Sykes. And I overheard him talking about me one time to another counselor. And he said that he didn't have any children, but if he did, he sure did hope that they would turn out a lot like me. And so when I told my social worker about that conversation, he said, well, we'll call and leave him a message. But he didn't finish the thought, which is, you know, I'm out of options here. I don't know who else to call. And fortunately, John Sykes was actually in his office correcting papers. Actually, he was in his office doing some paperwork. They had a rotation schedule. And he, because he was single and everybody else had the holidays with their family, he got the office duty over break.
Right. Well, he got it or he chose to do it because he was just
He got it. He got it. I think if it was up to him, he probably would have been, he wouldn't have gotten it. Right. But
yeah.
But, you know, John always insisted that he was meant to be there at that time.
And he said yes, right? He said, yeah, he
can
come
with
me.
Yeah, he said yes, and I went to stay with him that night. Now, Department of Social Services kept trying to find more permanent placement for me. They never did. And so I wound up staying with him until I went off to college a year later.
And you got a full ride.
I did.
But it was hard. It was hard work, right? Boston College. I have a lot of friends that have gone there. It's a great school.
It is a great school. It is a great school. It was like Oz to me. I mean, it was, you know, it was, and of course, I was remarking to my wife the other day, and this is again the naivete of a child. I never really realized how difficult what I was trying to do was. I just didn't realize the odds that I was up against. I had no idea of that because to me, I had a vision of where I wanted my life to go and I had a willingness to pursue it. But the odds of it, you know, I didn't fully grasp what I was up against. And that's, in a way, a good thing, you know?
You mean because if you had known how hard it might be, maybe you would have been perhaps handicapped in a way that didn't let you push forward because you're like, wow, this is not going to work. This is not going to be doable. I can't do it.
Yeah, not just that. I think the despair might have set in, you know, that I was going to have to settle. And you know, I certainly think that with my own children, I really have thought long and hard about the way that I have raised them. And I've tried to raise them like without pressure, because I think this generation is under enough pressure as it is. And I've tried to teach them about work ethic. And that if there are things that you want in life, you're going to have to struggle for that. You're going to have to sacrifice for it. You're going to have to work for it. But I try not to put any pressure on them to be something, to have a title and to go to this quote unquote great school. And it's in part because I don't think those are the most important things. I've watched a lot of parent-child relationships get altered because of it. So I think that sense of exploration of wonder is what I benefited from. And I want them to have that same experience too.
Do you think that your reading, especially your early reading, do you think that helped you to become such a good writer? Because, you know, you're a really good writer, and I'm going to say this, and there's lots of people who have had very big experiences or very traumatic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they write a book, and the book's important because they've written it. But that doesn't mean it's well written.
I agree.
And yours really, really is.
No,
yours really is.
No, I agree. And I there's a couple of reasons for that. One is practical, to the point of your question, and the other is personal. The part of it that's practical is that if you read as much as I did, and the way that we see kids on social media today, always on their devices, always scrolling up and down, always, that's how much I was reading. Mm. If I was not eating or doing some chores, I was reading constantly.
Right. But I want our listeners to know you had to hide your reading. You had to go into the basement and hide your books, hide your reading, because the Robinsons disapproved. In fact, they were probably suspicious of it. And they, yes, and Mr. Robinson couldn't read, right?
Right.
That was humiliating to him, probably, that you could.
Yeah, it was. And what's more, I think at some base level, they knew that reading was empowering. And
yeah, I bet they did. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, you know, you hear the stories, and it's generally true. They had very much a slave master's mentality, which is that they would have preferred you to be uneducated and unaware and subject to manipulation. They wanted you that way, actually.
To keep you down.
Absolutely. Right. So when you hear these, and I've heard it, I need not name them, but one particularly well-known politician says, I love the poorly educated. Well, if they were to finish that thought, what they would really say is, I love the poorly educated so I can take advantage of you. That's the full sentence, actually.
Right.
But when you have a sense of reading, and in my case, it made me a very good student. And that's when I think the opportunity started to come. So the practical nature of the matter is that if you read as much as I did, it naturally follows that you would be a good writer. And it would naturally follow that you would be a good speaker as well. But reading is the first fundamental. And you're right, there are people who have had experiences, and there are people who are good presenters and a lot of polish. But the depth of the writing or the depth of the presentation is a direct reflection on how well read one is. Absolutely, it's a direct one. So the other, when it came to writing it, is the part, and now that's the part that's rather personal to me, which is that I didn't think that anybody was going to be able to write it as well as I could, even though that was not my day-to-day job. I work in human resources in corporate America. I'm immersed in the world of systems and benefits and policies and practices. You know, so a writer was not something that I did as a career. However, that didn't mean that it was something I couldn't do. And so I take and have long taken a great deal of pride in my writing. And that is, and yet I can also tell you though, Jane, the number, including like a few days ago, and for the umpteenth time, I get asked, did you write that?
Come on, did you write it? Did you get help? Come on, did you write it?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean,
this is what people ask you?
Yeah, no, you get it all the time. And again, it gets back to what we said earlier, though. That one of the big misses is that we don't see that people who navigate the world through the lens of adversity have some skills. And those skills are differentiators for them. And that's true mm-hmm. whether you have a disability, whether you have to navigate the world as somebody who is LGBTQ, but you can't tell anybody, or your English is not your first language. You know, those are experiences, and yet you're navigating through them, and you have skills as a result of them. Mine happened to be reading. Others, it could be music. Others, it could be painting. Others, it could be sports. But there's some other skill that you have that has very little to do with the circumstance you've been born into.
I want to ask you, because when you write about your wife in the book, it's very, very beautiful, and there's obviously a lot of love there. So I'm wondering, how did you learn how to do that? Because you didn't have that. You didn't have examples of that.
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that I do think that you also remember what it is that you never had. And when you know that and you navigate that, the void of what is not there is with you. It is. And so I think there should always be a part of you that recognizes those voids and say it's okay, you know, that that you have them. And subsequently, I think when there comes a time you have to make your own decisions about what you want your own life to look like, the people who are in your life are reflections of those things that you aspire to as a young person. So it's no accident that it's not just the person that I married, it's also the friends that I have, the relationships with people in my personal and professional life all are cut from the same cloth. They're optimists, they're resilient, they're gritty, they're determined, they're selfless. Because as you get older, you can make choices about who you want in your life. And so, you know, in many ways, Tanya is, you know, a reflection of all of that, because she just exudes joy and optimism. And she is, to me, an incredibly special person who has her own, you know, life journey. Mm-hmm. And so when we met, I think that's what connected us almost immediately, was that we had both come from home environments where we just were already walking through life saying, we're not going to live like that again. Now, in her case, it was the absence of her father, but she had an extraordinary, extraordinary mother.
Right. She had a great single mom, right?
Yeah, she really did. Her mother was like from, you know, another planet of human being that the majority of our species has not evolved to, because her mother.
Wow, that's something.
No, her mother was really, really remarkable, because her mother had her heart broken by Tanya's dad. Mm-hmm. And her response to that was to very quietly swallow that pain and pour herself into her children, into her son and daughter. And she did. And so she, and then Tanya is a reflection of that, you know. So and you pick that up almost immediately. At least I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is all related to what you write in the book so well. You say, create a better life than the one I had inherited. Mm. It's like you made the decision, I'm going to surround myself with this in the life I am creating. So because even if I didn't get it before, I'm going to have it now.
Yeah, that's a certain kind of super skill, a superpower that I would say any young person has, and those of us who are trying to care for those can offer them the haven in which they can do that. How else is that going to change? There's a lot of young people that I encounter, and I say to them quite candidly, yeah, what you've inherited is not fair. It's not fair. It's not right. And I wish this were not the case. I really do. However, I also know this is not going to change unless you decide to change it. And here's why I think that you can. This, and it can be, you know, it can be a tough thing to have to communicate, to say, you know, look, there are things that, yes, they're not your fault, but they're still your responsibility. And that may not be fair, but that is the reality of them. Even those who want to, one of the most generous of heart, can't want something more for you than you can want for yourself. And so for a lot of us who meet children in crisis, and we're trying to save them in a lot of cases, pouring everything that we have into them, and find ourselves, you know, in some ways disappointed by the outcome. Boy, we couldn't save that one. But they've got to be willing at some point, you and only you can decide that you're worth saving. And what I find is that's when the lighthouses show up in your life, is when you draw that line in your own mind and you say, okay, so this is going to end. You know, this is going to end. And in my case, it was the thing that drove me the most was, okay, this is going to end one way or the other. Whatever I've got to do, this is going to end. And it has, because my three have not grown up the way that I did. And they have not grown up the way that Tanya did with the absence of her father. In fact, a few months ago, we have two children in college and one about to be, and we were talking to our youngest son. And at one point in the conversation, can't remember exactly what we were talking about. We were leaning on him about something. Can't remember exactly what it was about. But it was an amicable conversation. And can't remember exactly what we were talking about. But we were saying something along the lines of, we think you can do better or something. But it wasn't, and I wish I remember what it was, because, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. And I said to him, I said, you know, Vaughn, you know, I said, this is just tough, man. It's just tough to have parents like this. You know, it's not fair for you to have two parents like this who, you know, are willing to pour this much into you. I said, it's just not fair, you know, and he's laughing about it, right? And then at one point I said to him, I said, Vaughn, you know, when me and your mom were 20 years old, I said, your mom was wondering where her father was, and I was wondering who my father was. And he just starts cracking up because he knows it's all relative, right? It's all
right, now. Right.
There's a lot more seriousness to it than that, right? I mean, it's like, no, we were resolved that we were going to try and, you know, create a better life for them.
So what's in the future for you now?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot to be said just for living life with the blessings that you have, you know, and enjoying life as it is, you know. I mean, just a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, well, I don't really buy that. No, I don't buy that with you. I think I don't buy it. I mean, I think that's really true, but I suspect you got a bunch of things on your plate that you haven't yet tasted.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, and that will always, you're right, that will always be the case. What I was saying was that's only one, the full continuation of that, that's only one tine in the fork, you know, for me.
Okay.
So
yeah.
One of them is, yeah. Yes. And probably the first one is that, you know, I have to, you know, I do have to start with what I feel fortunate, right? And then I think you're also trying to better the world in whatever way you can, you know. And I also find myself immersed in a whole number of projects. So, for example, I've just partnered with the book publisher, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, to recognize teachers from across the country who wake up every day like Claire Levin and John Sykes did. And just trying to recognize in a small way how important teachers are in all of our lives, actually. And so I...
Right. Can you tell me about... Yeah. This has to do with a little bit with your most recent book, The Lighthouse Effect, right?
Yeah. So in The Lighthouse Effect...
Is it related to that?
Yeah. Which is the third book I've written. And it's about these 10 people I've met along my life journey. And I write about the experiences that I had, the interactions that I had with them and or their families that awakened me to one of the attributes of the lighthouse and therefore can awaken us all. They were affirming in some things, a reminder of others. And so I wanted to become something of their biographers, and I have been for these 10 people. At the same time, I also wanted to leave with audiences a way for them to really think about how they can have an impact on somebody else's life by being a lighthouse and also finding a lighthouse for themselves, because we all need lighthouses. We all can be one and we all need one.
So I want to ask you one last thing that I ask all of my guests, and I'm also going to ask you to dig deep.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know you can do. So what is the one thing that no one would ever know about you unless you told them?
Let's see. Yeah, you wouldn't know. Let me think about that for a minute. There's a couple of them. Yeah, and I think when you write a book in the way that I have, it's like, you know, there's a lot that folks know about you, right? So,
Well, you think everything's out there, but I just know it's probably true.
I don't think there's other stuff. Yeah, and this is not tongue in cheek because this is generally true. I don't think that most people would know that I am a huge fan of the band Journey.
Oh,
yeah. Unless I told you, you wouldn't know that.
No, I would not guess that.
No.
What do you think about the new singer, the Filipino guy? He's pretty awesome, right?
Arnel Pineda is his name.
Yes, I'm sorry. I should know his name.
and he's a little bit more than awesome. Although you're right. You're right. He is awesome.
All right. So why Journey? Why?
I mean, think about, you know, their song, Wheels in the Sky, Don't Stop Believing. I mean,
All the messages.
All the messages is why I gravitated to Journey. And if you're an 80s kid, you know, it was Journey of Chicago. And the story, you want to be blown away by something. Find the documentary. I think it's on any of the streaming platforms. The documentary called Don't Stop Believing. And it's the story of how the band found the replacement for Steve Perry, who was the lead singer of Journey.
Who was the lead singer.
Yes. Right. And now, if you follow Journey at all, even if you don't.
Not a lot.
Right. No, even if you don't, if you've heard any of the songs by Journey, when Steve Perry was a lead singer, you realize Steve Perry is a bad man.
Yeah.
And almost like Mick Jagger. How are you going to find another sound like that?
Right.
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 I mean,
he really had pipes.
Almost impossible, really, right? How do you find another Steve Perry? But they did.
But they did. I know.
And the way they did, so I'm not going to tell you or tell listeners, but the way they did will blow you away and is a full 180 to what you and I have been talking about. It's that good.
And you're not going to tell us?
No, I'm not going to tell you. You got to watch it. Because, it'll take you, on pun intended, it'll take you on a journey.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to add? I mean, we haven't talked about a lot of the things I want to talk about because you've had a lot of stuff happen in your life. But is there anything that you'd like to add right now?
Well, one, I do certainly appreciate the time with you and thank you for all that you're doing. I do want to share a note of gratitude and appreciation for, you know, anyone who is working to better the lives of young people, especially those who are in the system and or have navigated their way through it. It's a special person who becomes a CASA, who is a social worker, and not a day passes that I am not on the receiving end of a story from somebody. And at the center of that story oftentimes is a connection with my own story and a story about somebody who helped them along the way. And in these times where polarization is profitable and pitting people against each other is also profitable, we need something to sit on the other scale. And especially those who are trying to better the lives of young people are really good examples for how we all can live.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Because sometimes when I'm doing the work, I think, you know, can I do it? And then I figure, you know what? If it's going to help a kid, yeah, I can do it.
Well, there's this beautiful Greek proverb that says, a society grows great when the elders of that society plant trees in whose shade they know they will never sit.
That's very nice.
And there's a couple of messages in there. One about responsibility, but what a responsibility we have to build a better world. And the other is that we will almost certainly never live in that better world. You know, you do not get to see exactly how it turns out, at least not in this life. You don't get to see how, even in those moments of doubt and uncertainty about whether or not you can help someone, you don't really get to see 50 years down the road when you see actually how much you really did help. And there's something that is worthy in that.
Thank you, Steve. It's I really appreciate you responding to my reach out and then for making the time to record. I think it's really important what you've written and what you're talking about right now, and I hope a lot of people hear about it.
Well, I appreciate that, and then some, Jane. Pleasure spending the evening with you.
Thank you, Steve, for sharing your story with us. It's been great having you on the show, and I think the many values that you hold dear can be an inspiration for everyone, not just those with a lived foster care experience. And I agree, we could all do better with a lighthouse. Journey on. Our next guest is Peter Mutabazi. Peter fled an abusive father and his home in a small village in Uganda when he was just a young boy and lived on the streets of Kampala, fighting for food and his life, until a kind stranger took an interest in him and changed his life forever. Peter eventually emigrated to the U.S. and now repays that kindness by fostering children in the dependency system. He also adopted a young boy who came to his home after many failed placements and now is the child's forever father. Peter is the author of the memoir, Now I Am Known, Message of Hope to the Hopeless, the same message he needed to hear so badly as a child. So join us next week for Peter Mutabazi. Thank you for listening, and be well. If you see something, say something. If you suspect a child's health or safety is jeopardized in any way by parents or anyone else, contact the Child Protective Services Agency in your county. 24-hour hotlines are staffed by trained social workers who will help you through the process, and you can do so anonymously. In California, you can call the Child Protection Hotline at 800-540-4000. So if you see something, say something. You might be saving a child's life. If you want to know more about becoming a CASA anywhere in the country, go to nationalcasagal.org. And in LA, casala.org. And if you want to know more about becoming a foster parent, check out the National Foster Parent Association at nfponline.org. There's also faithfosterfamilies.org and adoptuskids.org. There's tons of other information online as well, so you can just hunt around. We also want to thank the supremely talented Christina Apostolopoulos for her beautiful original music. You can find her music on Spotify or Instagram at Christina Aposta. And also thank you to Yukon Har for his engineering. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear and you find it as valuable as we do, please rate us and hit subscribe. You can also make a donation at bonusbabies.org. See you next time.